We are going to continue talking with Dean Radin about his book, Real Magic. We'll also get into those random number generators that were used during the presidential election and see how they fared. And we'll take your calls when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, back with Dean Radin. Dean, we were talking about the random generators during the 2016 presidential election. Now, were these the older generators or the new ones?
These were the new ones.
The new ones. Okay, and tell us how it worked.
Well, we were discussing at work how to, what would be the next step to take. We had a little conference with Roger Nelson and the other people involved in mm-hmm. the Global Consciousness Project, and we kind of decided that we don't actually know why these effects work the way they do, so we need to develop new instruments. So we're fortunate at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, where I work, that one of our folks now is Lauren Carpenter, who was one of the first employees at Pixar. He won a couple of Academy Awards for the development of methods that are used in every CGI film today. So Lauren has retired from Pixar, and he's now working with us. And he's really, really good with hardware. So we thought about this idea of making a quantum noise generator that would record the noise rather than turning it into bits. So we record noise in 32 independent channels from the same kind of components that are used in a commercial random generator, record the noise at 1 kilohertz, 1,000 samples per second. So this thing produces a huge amount of data, but so what? Data is cheap today, so we can still analyze it. So what we can do with that now is we can do two kinds of analyses, and this was based on this metaphor of a disturbance in the force. But my interpretation of a disturbance in the force is that it's like a warping in space and time. It's a momentary warp. That's what Obi-Wan Kenobi felt when a planet was blown up, this warp in space-time. So you can see in a noise signal, if you do what's called an autocorrelation, you're looking at self-similarity of the signal in time, over time. So you can do that with this massive data set. See how similar the random noise is over time. You could also then, because we have 32 channels, you could look at how each channel is similar to each other, and that's now looking at a spatial effects through space. So if you see simultaneously a deviation in the spatial measure and a deviation in the temporal measure, that's like seeing a space warp. So we recorded for a couple of days before the presidential election to 4 or 5 days afterwards, and there's one point in both the temporal measure and the spatial measure where you get this big spike. It's right at midnight Pacific time on November 9th. That's when all of the news organizations called the election for Trump. And so in the first case, for the for the autocorrelation analysis, which is the temporal effect, the odds against chance of seeing a spike right at that time was 226 million to 1.
Wow.
And for the what's called mutual information analysis, which is the spatial effect, at exactly the same time, we get a odds against chance of 81,000 to 1. So what this suggests is that the shock of people, some in a positive and some in a negative direction, but nevertheless, a lot of people were shocked when the election was finally closed. Right at that point, we saw this, what looks like Obi-Wan would said, there's a disturbance in the force. It creates something like a warp in space-time.
So it wasn't a predictor, but it was something that clearly showed reaction.
Right. It showed a reaction. So on the predictor side, we're taking a completely different approach now. That doesn't involve random generators at all. We're taking data from Twitter. And you may know that there are a lot of people who are using Twitter, the tweets that people produce, and they do an analysis called a sentiment analysis, which is looking for positive affect or negative affect, simply looking for emotion in the words used in the tweets. And you can show that in some cases you can use those words to predict things like violence, like riots, because you can see in a given area that people are getting more and more anxious and emotional. And if there's other reasons to expect that there might be a riot, then that acts as an indicator. But we're taking a different approach. We're using the sentiment analysis to gauge emotion and we're looking for lone wolf shooting attacks. We want to see if we can use Twitter to predict not only that something is going to happen, but also where and
that
when.
Would be so important.
Yeah.
What a tool for law enforcement.
So the first thing we're testing then is the Las Vegas shooting last October. And we have a week worth of Twitter data from everywhere in the United States, 1 week before to 1 week afterwards. And you can see at the time of the shooting, there's a huge change, as you can imagine, that the negative sentiment goes through the roof.
After the fact, right?
Yeah. So the question now is, what happens if we go backwards in time? You go look at the same measurement, but you go backwards before the shooting. Do you see something there as well? And you can do the opposite. You can say, let's look at positive sentiment. Well, positive sentiment dropped like a rock at that when the shooting happened, but you can go backwards in time for that too. So we're still in the midst of the analysis, and we're seeing some interesting indications, perhaps, that something was going on before. And this is roughly about 1 day before you begin to see the data begins to behave differently.
Now, how does that work, Dean? Does that mean that there were some people who might have known something prior to the event happening? Or
no,
was that Stephen Paddock guy doing anything on Twitter?
I don't think so. We know from when you buy the tweets, you get a huge amount of information about each tweet. You know where the person is, you know something about them. I mean, your data is not private, let's put it that way.
Right, we know that.
So you can then also look at the tweets and decide, are people talking about this as a shooting event? And sometimes they'll have words like shooting or gun.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, it's talking about emotion. Like someone's mad at their girlfriend.
Right.
Somebody gets drunk, something like that. These are indications of negative emotion that's expressed in many different ways. And that's the sort of thing that we're looking for.
So what can you conclude by this? That somehow the conscious mind is tapping into emotion of all these people who may have these precognitive abilities. They may not even know it, but they're showing up on the generators.
Well, remember, these are not generators. We're talking here about tweets.
Tweets,
yeah.
That's
so
right.
These are thinking of people kind of as generators. This is the same general idea as with the random number generators. You get a huge collective mind, and the collective mind is not necessarily just focused on real time. It may be extended through space and time. That's what all of these studies are saying, that most of the time our conscious awareness is focused on here and now, but not all the time. Sometimes we get snatches of things from the future or the far distance. So if you have enough people, we're taking advantage of what amounts to collective intuition. If people get a sense that something bad feels like it's going to show up and they have no idea consciously what it is, they might become a little bit more angry or a little bit more emotional.
Mm-hmm.
That would be expressed in the tweets in this case. And what we hope then is that not only can we tell that something is about to unfold, but also where. Because from a law enforcement perspective,
that's what they
know where it's not useful.
Exactly, exactly.
So that's why we got the tweets from everywhere in the United States.
What can you conclude by this experiment at this point?
Well, at this point, it looks like we haven't yet done the narrowing down as to location yet. So we're only at this point looking at, is there any kind of indicator at all?
Of an event.
Yeah, that something's about to happen. So what we can say is roughly a day before the event, it looks like the data, meaning the sentiment data that you get, is behaving differently. In order to know whether the signal that we see is really real, we're going to need to get like a couple of months of data beforehand and a couple of months afterwards. So we're still only working with 1 week before and 1 week afterwards, and that's why we need to expand the length of the data. And unfortunately, buying tweets is not cheap.
No, that's true.
So we'll eventually, if we can get a grant or something, we'll be able to extend this and look out farther and farther in time, and that way get a better and better idea about whether or not what we think looks like a signal is in fact a signal.
Do you think that the locations will show that you will have more information from individuals in that specific location?
Yes, that's the hope.
That's
the hope is that in Las Vegas, plus or minus 10 miles, say, that's where people are really starting to feel something.
You see a spike because they can feel that region.
Right.
Interesting. All right, let's go to the phones. West of the Rockies, John is in Oregon. Welcome to the program, John. Go ahead.
Well, hello.
Hi, John.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so happy to be on here.
Well, we're glad you got through. Go ahead.
I am also I use tarot as a divination.
Uh-huh.
I've been doing it for well over a decade now. And just as well, I guess I don't even really have a question, except for what do you consider magic?
Well, that's for you, Mr. Raiden.
Yep. Well, as I said, and if you consider magic, part of it is the practice, and part of the practice is divination, including tarot. So, yeah, that is magic. It's those three classes of practices. In fact, another way of thinking about what magic is magic is to religion as technology is to science. You get that analogy? Magic is a practical application of ideas that are normally associated with religion, with religious or even mystical ideas. It's an application. Whereas, just like technology is an application of basic science. So the same is true of alchemy, for example. Alchemy was a application of ideas and concepts that came out of the esoteric cosmology, esoteric ideas. It turned into natural magic because you're able to do things that no longer required a divine intervention. Natural magic then turned into science, as we know it today.
Who do you think affects tarot, the reader or the person, the recipient?
Well, we don't actually know. My guess is that in most cases, it's the individual whose intuition is focused by the cards that come up. So the divination is not something happening in the cards itself. It's your interpretation.
It's your interpretation of them.
I mean, the best astrologers I know will say that the chart gives them a way of focusing on the thing that you want to know. And sometimes it's synchronistic. The chart shows something that you want to look for. But more often, the chart acts as what amounts to a mandala.
First-time caller George in Corpus Christi, Texas. Good morning, George. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Mr. Norrie. It is an absolute honor to be on your show. It's the first time.
Actually
the second time I called. I called last night with Mr. Serrett.
Oh, great.
And it was a wonderful show, as always. And my question is, as magic, as you say, is an extension of higher consciousness, are we evolving towards that as beings, as humans, or has it always been there? Or because you say magic is an extension of a higher consciousness, so are we in evolution to get to that point?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And my guess is no, that it was always here. It's part of the fabric of reality. There isn't any indication that I know of that shows that magic was more effective way back when. I mean, certainly the history of magic is saturated with all kinds of superstitions, which was one of the reasons why it's so difficult to try to rationally make any sense out of it. But my guess is that we're talking about the nature of consciousness itself, and that may not have changed. We, as embodied beings, have changed over time, but the consciousness itself, I don't think that has changed, in which case we have the same capacity to perform magic now as shamans did 50,000 years ago.
What's the difference between what you call big C consciousness and little C consciousness?
Well, the big C is the universal consciousness.
All right.
This background thing which is wrapped into the fabric of reality. And little C consciousness is the thing inside your head that you call me. And most of the Eastern traditions and all of the Western esoteric traditions say that the thing that you call me inside your head, the thing that is aware, is exactly the same as the universal consciousness. It doesn't seem like the same because our minds and our brains are constrained where we think we are and who we think we are. But as we see again and again by mystics and long-term meditators, you get down deep enough into levels of consciousness, you begin to see the truth of this idea that there is only one consciousness. It's all big C.
Mm-hmm.
We walk around with this illusion that of little c inside our head.
So the one is just as important as the many.
Well, there is only the one. The many is an illusion.
And
one of my favorite sayings is from Ramana Maharshi, who was asked, how should we treat other people? And his response was, there are no other people.
We do on Fridays, Dean, what is called the Friday Prayer Group. And let me tell you how it works. We've been doing it for 12, 13 years now. But on Friday, I've asked our listeners to just take a little time out of their day and concentrate on a projected list of people with afflictions and ailments. And I have people email me. I don't publish it. I have people email me, and they go, would you please put on our list Aunt Hilda, who's got lung cancer? And so, you know, I'll accumulate this. But on Fridays, our listening audience, those people who participate on their own, you know, will just take a moment out of their day and just do a little prayer, thinking of the people on that list. I get really strange emails back from those people who asked for those individuals to be put on the list, saying they've been cured, they're better. Very rarely do I get something that they died or anything like that. I don't get those. I'm sure it happens. But how does that work?
Well, if in fact we were made out of consciousness, and consciousness is the thing that from which the physical world arises, then if you set your intention, this is part of consciousness, you manifest the world in a different way. We were interested. We did a big study some years ago on spontaneous remissions of serious diseases. And the strange thing about those, we're talking about something like a bony tumor that disappears overnight. That's impossible.
It is impossible,
except that it happens.
Yeah.
So it suggests that there's something peculiar about the nature of time or the nature of causality, which can happen. And I think that it is related in some way to the nature of consciousness itself, because that seems to be the source of why anything exists.
It's dramatic. It really is. And I love the fact, Dean, that you're out there doing this. How did you first get started in all of this?
It started in studying these kinds of things.
Yeah.
I think I read too many fairy tales when I was young, and I never grew up.
Well, I'm glad you never grew up, because it's amazing. And I guess you migrated to individuals, other scientists, other people who were thinking the same way.
Well, of course, I was
like Roger Nelson,
to find that there are many other people who are interested in this. Not too many are actively engaged in it. But I work with many, many people in prominent positions in the scientific world who are vitally interested in these topics, but they know that it's too risky to talk about it. So we talk privately. I'm more like a lightning rod because I'm in the public, but I know that there are lots and lots of scientists and scholars who are very interested in these topics.
We're going to come back with our final segment with Dean Radin and take your final phone calls as we talk about real magic right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dean's websites are linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. We are back with Dean Radin and your final phone calls here as we talk about his book, Real Magic. Great job on this, by the way, and it really makes you think, Dean.
Yeah, I would hope so. That's part of the idea.
That's what it's all about.
Just before the break, I mentioned that I talked to a lot of scientists, and I didn't really have a way of demonstrating that before other than what I've said. But we did a survey recently where we asked people from the general population and also scientists and engineers. We asked them not what they believed about these things, but simply what experiences have they reported. So the kinds of experiences, there are 25 on this survey, they're things like, have you seen something in your mind's eye about an object, person, location, or physical event? That would be like clairvoyance. Have you known something about the future that you had no normal way of knowing, like precognition, and a bunch of other things? So we kind of expected that the general population would be pretty high endorsement of these kinds of things. But we also expected that scientists would be quite low, because people think that maybe they have more education and they interpret these things different or whatever. So we ran the survey among the general population. 94% endorsed at least one of these kinds of experiences. So we thought, well, that's kind of high. We didn't think it would be that high, but it means these are very common experiences, the kinds that you discuss on your show. So then we then looked at the scientists and engineers. What percentage would you expect or would you guess that would endorse at least one of these kinds of experiences?
I would say it would be kind of low.
Yeah,
it was
93%.
That's astronomical.
It is almost exactly the same as the general population. And not surprisingly, because scientists and engineers are human. And these are human experiences. So a difference you begin to see when you ask people, what do you believe about them? So here's where belief can be quite a bit lower on scientists and engineers. And the reason that the belief is lower is because they interpret the experiences differently. Even if you're talking about an experience of telepathy or clairvoyance, these are the kinds of experiences people have, they might say, well, it's just coincidence. It's, you know, who knows what it is, but it's not spooky. So we actually went to the next stage and said, well, what if we only selected out here the experiences that were explicitly psychic? That what do you then see? And it remains exactly the same. Now it's a little bit lower, it's like 85%, but the general population and scientists and engineers both have the same report of those kinds of experiences. So this is one of the reasons why people talk to me all the time as scientists and engineers and scholars, because things happen to them and they don't know where else they can talk to about it. So one of the reasons I like writing popular books is because I know that a lot of them are purchased by people in the academic world.
All right, let's go to the phones again. Keith in Rochester, New York. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Yes, four fast points. High C consciousness is the cosmic consciousness that Jesus and the Buddha supposedly had, and there is a big diff between high C and low C. Secondly, in a tarot reading, it's the reader who controls the flow. They are the one who are assigning the values, and to say it, many people who are receiving the reading do not have that much intuition to begin with. Sorry, they just don't. They have no choice but to absorb what's being told them like a sponge. Third, when you're dealing with lone psychopaths like the Vegas shooter and the Austin bomber, it is often hard to back engineer their actions because they themselves are so out there, they don't know what they're doing. The Austin punk said into his telephone that he knew that he was a psychopath, but he was so out there, he was not a criminal mastermind, such as his poor disguise when he went into the post office. These guys are so random that your concern about the Vegas killer, it just must be acknowledged that with some crimes, we will never know the true motives of the bad guys. Again, with some psychopaths, they are just so far out there, they cannot be redeemed, and thus their actions and motives cannot really be ascertained. Fourth, I would like to ask, since most people whom I understand have an interest in magic, is it their way of trying to make up for the fact that both of you gentlemen have mentioned clairvoyance and precognition? When people delve in magic, it's really their way of saying, I want to be exactly that clairvoyant, to have precognition and to be telepathic. I know for myself, I've always looked at things if I were a human radio tower, I would quickly bring in the higher elevated Buddhist practice of Chod, C-H-O-D, which is like a warrior's mentality of simply accepting the universe as is, not me, Keith, trying to change anything, but have it come to me and I accept really at face value what is going on. In closing, that is how you understand the universe, anyone, is when you put down your own designs on what you have on the universe and simply invert yourself, let the universe come completely to you, and that is how you, the individual, really then do understand what's going on around you.
There's a lot to digest there, Dean, but give me some comments, if you would.
Well, so I actually agree with a lot of what he said, but in the case of the lone wolf, the reason why what we're doing is we don't care at all what motivations of someone is or why they do it. That's not part of this analysis at all.
No, you need to know where and when.
We need to know where and when a big event takes place. And we're taking advantage of lots of people who will learn about the event, some of whom are there and many are not there. With the assumption that everyone has these abilities to transcend space and time, that their emotions will be pushed by learning about the event. And so then you don't need to know anything about the shooter. It could be not even a shooter. It could be an accident. A bridge can fall down or something.
Sure.
And that it would still work with the method that we have.
Well, now that's interesting, because I was going to ask you, Dean, is it conceivable that with some of these, like the tweets you were saying, or even the random generators, that the perpetrator himself or herself, in some cases, that they are sending out this beam of information into the conscious world, out into consciousness, and it's being picked up by other people? That's so the individual who is the perpetrator, the shooter, let's say, he's the one sending this stuff out. And maybe doesn't even know he's doing it, but it's being picked up by other people.
Yeah, I expect that some people may be sensitive to that kind of intent. But again, we don't need to go there. We're taking advantage of collective intuition to sense large-scale events that affect lots of people. If we were to try to narrow down to the individual, then we would work with very talented psychics and ask them, do they feel like something is coming up? Then it's much trickier to do that, because they can pick up literally everything. So what do they narrow in on?
The late psychic Gene Dixon foretold of John F. Kennedy's assassination. I believe she even tried to warn him.
Mm-hmm.
It fell on deaf ears, unfortunately. Are there people out there with that kind of ability, in your opinion, who can pinpoint these events? I mean, did they know about 9/11? If they did, they didn't let us know. But are they out there?
There are some who claim that they are that good. The problem with it is it comes down to the level of anecdote, typically. They may even be able to show that they wrote an email to somebody saying that this is going to happen, and they may even be correct. The problem is that we don't know how many times they were not correct.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So that's why I always go right back to the laboratory to see whether, in principle, it's possible to get this kind of information rather than relying on an anecdote.
I mean, somebody may say there's going to be war with Syria. Well, all you got to do is make a little prognostication guess based on world events, and you might be right. I'm not sure that's psychic, is it?
No. There's so many other explanations that you don't need to go to the psychic. If somebody has a prediction that it seems extremely unlikely, and that comes to pass, well, then it's something else going on.
We've got Hal in Kentucky now. Welcome to the show, Hal. Go ahead.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I've been on your show before, and everything that you talk about on your show, I'm involved with in one way or another. I do psychic readings myself. I use cards, clairvoyance, hypnosis. I do the paranormal, psychic investigations, including UFOs. So I love your show.
Well, thank you. And you do it all, sounds like.
Anything that deals with New Age paranormal. I'm mainly a psychic reader. I use tarot cards. I use clairvoyance. I've done hypnosis, past lives, psychic healings, healing with souls. I got into the paranormal psychic investigation, so I used to be a private investigator. And since I switched over, I had a lot more calls. But
yeah, I bet.
I've been involved with magic. I want to ask your guest there his definition and his what he feels about. I've looked into voodoo and all that and creative visualization, but most of all, candle magic, which I find is very real. I've used it before. It's very powerful. I've gotten books from different bookstores, including Lou Ellen Press. And matter of fact, your friend's book might be through Lou Ellen, even. I don't know. But I want to know his definition, what he thinks about candle magic. And one quick question after that is how to recharge yourself when you feel like you're drained. So, but
all right, candle magic. We had a guest. She's no longer with us, Dean, Evelyn Paglini, who was a huge booster in candle magic. And she believed that various colors of candles did different things in terms of the affirmations and the spells. What do you think?
Well, candle magic is, the way I would interpret it is a very convenient way of focusing your attention and intention. And you use the word belief, which is also important. So if you believe that a certain color candle is going to help you focus your intention to make something happen, it is much more likely that that is going to happen. This is part of what I was suggesting about in the history of magic. It's full of theater and ritual. And the theater and ritual is important because it's a way of focusing your intention. It's not simply something in your head, but you might be involved in dancing or singing or chanting or something. And that helps get the ideas, the intention, out of your head and into the world itself. So a candle is particularly nice because the flame generally dances around a little bit and it holds your attention. And that's really the key in any form of magical practice.
And how do you recharge yourself when you're exhausted like Edgar Cayce was? I think it killed him eventually.
You take a vacation.
And just get your mind off all that stuff.
Do
huh?
something else, yeah.
All right. The Joe in Long Island, welcome to the show. Go ahead, Joseph.
Yeah, hi, Dean. There's a song, I'll Never Grow Up, by Twisted Sister. But my question would be, if you look at Malcolm Gladwell, he, in his book Outliers, he said you need 10,000 hours of practice to develop a skill, which I don't necessarily have 10,000 hours in my pocket. But I was thinking with prayer, you could just say a minute prayer for some weather change that's significant and then just check and see if it happens. You know, if you're asking for it to be 30 degrees hotter than it's been running. And the other thing would be, do they infuse magic in advertising or social media, good magic or dark magic, in this day and age?
Well, that's a very good question. As far as practice goes, the amount of time practicing is probably not as important as reaching the state of awareness where magic happens. So a magician would call it gnosis. A yogi would call it samadhi. Other mystics might just simply call it mystical union. So these are very deep states of awareness going down, keeping yourself to be aware as you go deeper and deeper into your subconscious typically. So that's where the magic takes place. So a person who is either naturally talented or well-trained could take 1 minute to get into that state, and then they can do effective magic. For the rest of us, if I'm simply walking around in my everyday state, and I get a whim for a second that I wish it would stop raining, that's not likely to do much because it's the intention is not coming from the place where magic occurs, which is in a very deep consciousness state. As far as infusing magic in advertising, our advertising is constantly manipulating our attention. So you don't need to go to magic to simply see that the point of advertising is to attract your attention. All advertising is a kind of clickbait. It's baiting you constantly with all kinds of images and colors and sounds. So it's possible, I think, that someone could put a spell on certain things that would make it even more attractive, but I don't think we even need to go there.
Dean, tell us where people can get your book, Real Magic, if you would, sir.
They can go anywhere where books are sold. They can go to deanraden.org or deanraden.com, and they'll be led to my book site, which has buttons that will go to the paperback, the ebook, or the audiobook. So this is the first book I've had that comes with an audiobook. Actually, it's not quite true. It's the second book. But this is the first book that has a reader in it where I was able to select who the reader was. So the person who read the audiobook is the same guy who has read many of the Dan Brown books,
like
Angels and Demons. He has a great voice.
Super. And I want to personally thank you, Dean, on behalf of everybody who listens to this incredible program, to thank you for the years of work and service that you and others like you have done to to bring us this incredible information. We really appreciate it.
That's very nice. Thank you.
Dean Radin, my friends. Dean Radin. Up next, we're going to be talking about Haunted America. So don't touch your dial right here on Coast to Coast AM.